first presenter is Ellen Rubin, who is here in EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. She's currently on a detail to the Office of the Administrator, but is still very excited about this work, and she's going to talk to us about some things that she's developed over the last few years. So I'll turn it over to you, Ellen.
Thanks, Michelle. Let me get this started with a little history of why I worked on these projects and why we're having this seminar. A few years back, this Office of EPA was hosting classroom trainings called Jumpstarting Ecological Revitalization Beyond Hydro Seeding. And I would go to these classes and sit in the back and listen, and I would hear the same questions being asked over and over again. And they were really good questions, and it didn't matter what office we went to, what location we were at, we got a lot of the same questions. And so after one of these trainings, it took me a while, but finally I came back to my office, and I said to my supervisor, why don't we answer these questions? You know, you have the people out in the field, they're working really hard, they're swamped, they don't have time to read 100-page documents. So let's get some really nice, good information, short, concise. We can do fact sheets. We wanted to keep them less than 12 pages. And so then we decided we were going to do a series of fact sheets on this issue of ecological revitalization. So turn to slide 2. Here we have the definition. You guys can read it for yourself. I'm not going to read it to you. But just realize that this is just a starting place. This is a definition that my office in Superfund came up with. And, you know, people went back and forth, and they had issue with this word and that word. And that's not what this definition is about. This is just the gist of it. We're trying to restore land that was damaged. We want to improve habitat, and we're trying to do a good thing here. So let's move on to slide 3. Here we have the list of the 3 fact sheets, and they are the frequently asked questions, revegetating landfills, and the attractive nuisance issues. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with attractive nuisance, but just in case you're not, once you clean up a site where you're leaving waste on site, people are worried that, you know, you'll restore the land, it'll look great, the animals will come back, and then is there any danger to any of the animals that are the wildlife that are coming back to the site. So let's move on to slide 4. And let me state that, you know, on these fact sheets, you know, you have Michelle and I who are, you know, engineers and soil scientists and have a great background, but we're not experts in these areas. So we were lucky enough to be able to really work with experts to have them review these fact sheets, give us good information so that we can send the folks out in the field the best information that we can. And the first fact sheet was frequently asked questions about ecological revitalization of Superfund sites. So what we did here is we just sent out an email to all our friends and practitioners that work in this area, some family members, Aunt Susie, whoever. We sent out the email for asking people, what questions do you have about ecological revitalization that you would like answered? And we received many responses. We could group them in about 30 questions, but they were all across the board. You know, people want to know the legalities of it, who pays for it, what type of sites to clean up. And so we tried to consolidate all those questions and put it into our first fact sheet, which was really just a basic fact sheet. We wanted to answer some basic questions. It had the definition, which you saw on the last slide, what types of sites, and also to give people a flavor and a beginning point to continue on in answering these questions. And what's really helpful in this fact sheet is refer folks to additional resources. So if this is new to you or something you're just starting working on, I highly recommend looking at this fact sheet. Look at the additional resources if there's a certain question you have, and it'll answer a lot of your questions. So let's move on to slide 5. This is on revegetating landfills and waste containment areas. This is a question I kept hearing no matter what presentation, no matter what conference, wherever I went. They wanted to know, can you revegetate a landfill? And, you know, during these question presentations, we had an expert in the field who would get up and say, yes, yes, you can, no problem. But I think until you really have it in writing, people don't believe it, or they can't reference it, or they can't show the owner of the site or their boss. So that's another reason we did it. Excuse me. We did these fact sheets. So this fact sheet basically just answers the question: yes, you can, and it tells you how. Types of vegetation you should use, how you can establish your plans, maintenance, lesson learned, and again, additional resources. All of these fact sheets, because they are short, they refer you to additional resources, links. All these fact sheets are also on our website on cluein.org, and I think it was on one of the first slides of the website. It's cluein.org eco-revitalization. So let's move on to slide 6 and the last of the series of fact sheets. And this was on attractive nuisance issues. So this fact sheet defines attractive nuisance. And basically this wasn't such an easy yes and no fact sheet. As the last one was, you know, can you revegetate landfills? Well, yes, you can. This wasn't a yes or no. So what we thought the best way to handle this issue was to talk about what the attractive nuisance issues are, how do you assess if it could be an issue at your site, and, you know, if you remediate the site correctly and all goes well, then it shouldn't be an issue, but how do you know that? So we're telling you how to assess it, how to manage the site so it doesn't become an issue further on, but the best way we thought to really describe and explain the attractive nuisance issues was through case studies. So we have 5 short case studies that illustrates different problems and the solutions that were addressed at different sites across the country. So if you're worried about managing a site that wildlife might come back at, that you still have waste there, I recommend this fact sheet. Okay, let's move on to slide 7. So we're switching gears here for a second. So those were a series of 3 fact sheets that are all completed. They're all online. We are open to doing more fact sheets, and we're looking for your input because we want to answer the questions that you have. So if you have any suggestions or questions that you think need to be answered, please email us and send us some suggestions, and we'll be happy to continue working on those fact sheets. But another project that I worked on, probably beginning of 2006, is I was talking with some folks in our EPA office in New Jersey and the environmental response team, and that they were using amendments to restore land that was damaged, and they were having really good results. But they still had some questions, and people weren't catching on as much as you would think, considering all their good results. So we decided to gather a bunch of the experts across the country. We had about 20 to 30 folks, and we had some phone calls and did some outlines of papers we should write to really get the word out about the good work that has already been done using amendments to restore damaged land, but also to answer some of the questions that still existed. So, you know, a bunch of phone calls and getting folks together, and then finally in August of 2006, about 20 of these experts sat down in Chicago, hot, humid, couldn't go anywhere, it was miserable, and we just sat for 3 days and we worked. And at the end, we decided to come up with 2 products. One was a white paper that gives you all the background information on using amendments, and that's called the Use of Soil Amendments for Remediation, Revitalization, and Reuse. Sorry for that little typo there. And then the second one was a web-based tool, and it's called Soil Remediation, Revitalization, and Reuse, Technical Performance Measures. And this one was based on the fact that, okay, once you have the information, you know how to use amendments, well, how can you prove that the site is restored, that it's safe for people and animals? And so this is what this web-based tool does. It gives you different methods and analysis techniques to prove that your site has been restored and it's ready for reuse. Okay, so let's move to slide 8. So this, I'm just going to go into a little more detail on the two products. And the first one is the white paper, the use of soil amendments for site remediation, revitalization, and reuse. And this mainly focuses on using the soil amendments to restore land contaminated with metals. And common amendments are municipal biosolids, animal manures, sugar beet lime, wood ash, composted material, fertilizers. They're all listed in the paper with lots more information. Let's move on to slide 9. So why should we use amendments? Well, the amendments restore soil qualities by balancing pH, adding organic matter, they increase the water holding capacity, reestablishing microbial communities, and alleviating compaction. So basically, I'm sorry for that long list, but it's really a useful technique, and what they do is they enable site remediation, revegetation, revitalization, and reuse. And it's ideal because you're taking the waste product from one industry, and you're, instead of it being landfilled or considered waste, you're reusing it to clean up damaged land, restore the ecosystem, and it's just a win-win situation. So let's move to slide 10. The way that this paper was set up, it's based around four separate tables. We had when the experts in the field sat around in Chicago and thought, how do they want to do this paper? We didn't want a long 100-page paper that's, you know, might have a lot of good information, but it'd be hard for folks to get through. What we decided to do is base it around four tables and write the report around these tables. So you can either look through the tables or read the report or use this white paper any way you would like. The first table talks about the type of problem that the soil amendment can address. So problems consist of toxicity, high or low pH, salinity, poor soil properties, nutrient deficiencies. And so, for example, if you had a problem such as toxicity of lead, you would go to the table and you look under toxicity, and all the metals are listed. It's alphabetical, so it's easy to find. And you find lead, and you go over the column. It also talks about, you know, what the exposure pathway may be, an adverse effect. It has more information, any interaction with anything else in the site you might be worried about. But ultimately, it comes down to the last column, which is your solution. So if you had a problem like lead, your solution would be raise the pH to 6 or greater by adding phosphorus and or iron oxides, as long as there's no arsenic present. And so you have a problem and solution like that in Table 1. For another example, if you had maybe a problem of soil properties and it was your aggregation wasn't right, so you can look again, see what the adverse effects are and the interactions, and then you'd have a solution such as add organic matter and gypsum. So that's Table 1. It's sort of like a problem and solution table. Table 2 is similar in that it's a problem and solution table, but it's based on what type of site you had. Instead of your contaminant, it would be what type of site. So if you had a mining site, refineries, construction sites, you know, different types of sites, you'd look at the table through your site problem, and it would have the site problem and a solution. Now, with each site is also associated a different contaminant that might be common in that site. So, for example, let's say your site was a coal waste pile. You would have your list of contaminants in the next column, then what that problem was. So it would tell you more of, you know, what the cause, phytotoxicity, or what the problem is, and then it would have a solution. So for coal waste piles, the solution would be to add lime to correct acidity, add organic matter to revitalize soil. You might want to lighten the surface color to prevent heat kill of seedlings. And there's more detail, of course, in the paper. Just trying to give you a feel for how this paper is based. So now the next table, it's four tables, so we're only at table 2. The next table, table 3, is more informative, as is table 4. Table 3 talks about the soil amendments. So maybe, you know, you found out your problem and now you have a solution, you need to add organic matter or a different type of amendment. You would go to table three and that would list all the different types of amendments and it will give you information about that. The availability, what's it used for, is it used for a nutrient source, organic matter, public acceptance. Now that's a big thing, you know, if you're at a site and maybe the public's mad about it, you want to be sure to be using some type of amendment that everyone can agree with. It talks about cost, advantages, disadvantages, and this table provides links for further information. So if you need to get more information, here's the table to look at. And then the last table is table four, and this talks more about logistics, and it's another informative table. So you would, you know, look through what type of organic amendment you have, and then you would get information on storage, transport, what type of equipment you might need to blend it, to put it on top. So these four tables can be looked at separately, or can be, so there can be standalone if you just have a specific question, but they can be used interactively to, you know, to start your site to the finish or the conclusion of how you'd like to clean it up and all everything you need to think of logistically, public acceptance. And so you can just look at these tables or you can read the whole report. And so it's a nice tool that you can just use as a reference or you could read the whole thing. So that's the white paper. So let's move on to slide 11. Which is soil remediation, revitalization, and reuse technical performance measures. So this is the internet-based tools. And why we developed this product is that when we were talking to the folks in the environmental response team in EPA's New Jersey office, they were having really great success of using soil amendments, restoring damaged land, revitalizing the ecosystem, and it was pretty cost-effective. But what they were having trouble with was proving that this remedy was working. So they had to use so many tests and analysis and swine tests that it became so expensive that proving that the remedy worked was actually more costly than the remedy. So we decided we would do this technical performance measures tool, and we weren't sure if we should do a matrix or a report, but what we best thought at the end was to do an internet-based tool. And this tool will just allow you to see if the site that you've designed for the soil amendments are functioning correctly, that it's protective to human health and the environment, and that if the site is ready for reuse. And we tried to find a core set of technical performance measures, about half a dozen, that are commercially available, cost-effective, they're proven. And so that's in this tool. You have these core technical performance measures, but your site might be very specific. So we have many, many others that when you go through the matrix and you go through the database might come out with a different test that's specific to your site. So let me tell you a little bit more about this, then we'll move to slide 12. So you go to the website, and the user's manual is right on the website, and that is also on cluin.org. And you can read the user's manual, but it's pretty user-friendly. You just go to TPM search, and you have five questions here that you could fill out. Let me go back for 1 second. Because what we're looking here, let me make sure I was clear, is that we want to say that the remedial success for using soil amendments is defined. And so what we mean by remedial success is reduction of risk to human health and the environment. And that's what we're trying to prove right here. So you can go through these five questions. You know, what is your goal? What is your exposure pathway? What are you evaluating? What are you measuring? How will you test it? You could drop down and there's many choices depending on what your site has. So for your goal, is it, you know, it could be something like characterize soil contamination, evaluate soil health, ecosystem function, reduce dust generation, for exposure pathway, you know, is it direct exposure from groundwater, is it from soil? You know, it all depends on your site. What are you evaluating? What's your performance point? Is it bioavailability? Is it accumulation? Is it mobility? You know, what do you want to measure? Are you looking for availability to plants? Are you looking for total contaminants? And then the last one is how will you test it? Do you want to do soil fertility, animal bioaccumulation? So these are all in the pull down on the website. And so you can, maybe you just have one goal, and so you just use the drop-down from the first question. Maybe you want to have answers for all these things. You know, it depends on your site, what you're looking for. So you would, for example, we'll do the first one. What is your remediation and revitalization or reuse goal? So go to slide 13, and you can see the drop-down there, and we've chosen reduce contaminant bioavailability. And so that's the only thing we chose. And then go to slide 14, and you can see that two different analyses came up, the laboratory plant bioassay and plant tissue residue. So to get more information, you would just click on them. So if you clicked on the laboratory plant bioassay, you go to slide 15, and you can see, get some more information that we thought was very important. You know, what's the availability of it? Is it readily available? What's the cost? You know, if it's too high of a cost, you might not want to use it. Is it standardized? Yes, no. You know, maybe you want to use a new performance measure, but maybe you don't. And then more information. I'll have some write-ups about maybe how to do the test, where to get more information, further links. And so that's how this works. And we really hope that this would help you prove that once you used the soil amendments for remediation, restoration, revitalization, and reuse, that you can then go look at some of these analyses and prove in a cost-effective manner that it is working and it's ready for reuse and protective of human health and the environment. So let's move to the last slide of my presentation, which is slide 16. And so Michelle and I are continuing to work on this, Michelle more so than I. But if you have any questions or you'd like to suggest a fact sheet or anything else you'd like to address, please let us know because we'd be happy to work on it. Thank you. And I think Michelle's going to go next. And then, so I worked on this, and now I'm on detail. Michelle came just as I left on detail, so we're like a tag team, and she's been continuing to work on it. So she'll be able to tell you on some of the newer products that we have and things that should be coming out, and then we'll have some question and answers.
Great. Thanks, Ellen. So if you move to slide B1, my first slide, the introductory slide, and like Ellen said, I am here in the Superfund office on detail from the solid waste office. Basically, I've been here for about 6 months, and I'm going to present to you some of the projects we've been working on in the last 6 months and some thoughts we've been having on where to go in the future. My goal is to provide you with information on the tools we're developing and, like Ellen suggested, request your feedback. We always like to hear what the users need. I think you'll find our resources very beneficial when you're planning your site restoration activities, and I definitely encourage you to consult these resources. So what I'm going to present is a little bit more information about our internet seminars and case studies, a new eco restoration of land internet tool that we've just made live in the last 2 weeks, and then talk a little bit about research on carbon sequestration as it's related to these eco-restoration of contaminated lands activities. So you can move to slide D2. I just wanted to give a plug for the last seminar in the series that we're doing on presenting ecological restoration resources to you, and that will be this Wednesday, December 5th, from 2 to 4. EPA's Office of Solid Waste, Sarah Rasmussen, will present some information available through RCRA Corrective Action, and Bob Bastian from the Office of Water will present information on using biosolids for restoration. And the website is up on this slide. If you want to register, there's where you can get the information to do that.
I also want to point out that all the seminars, any seminars that are done on Kluwen are archived, but I'm particularly pointing out in the next point all the presentations that are related to eco-restoration, most of which I think Ellen probably was responsible for organizing prior to me coming. But there's 8 of them that are available to view at any time. You can download the files and listen to the audio as if you were there that day. However, if you have questions, you would have to contact the individual separately since it's no longer live. And I'll mention that the first one in the list was just last week in which NOAA, BLM, and NRCS presented resources that they have available for folks who want to do this at their sites. And like I said, in the future, we always appreciate your input. You can contact me with any ideas you have for seminars you'd like to see in the future. And we can move to the next slide, D3. Another thing that we're going to be working on in the next few months is developing more case studies. I've been working with our contractor Tetra Tech to develop a database of ecological revitalization sites. Basically, all the sites that we could identify, Superfund, RCRA Corrective Action, and anything else, where they have done eco-revitalization, and we're kind of culling together that list, and hopefully it will be posted online soon. We want to identify at least 3 case studies to highlight in the course of the next 6 months, and we're looking at one site in Crozet Township in Virginia, where the site was contaminated with arsenic because it was a former orchard site, and they had used ferns that had the ability to remove the arsenic from the site. So there is a video on Kluwen.org about this site. We're going to be having a TNT article hopefully in the spring on this site. And hopefully we would have identified more sites at that point to have in the article. And then the plan is to present these case studies as internet seminars as you're viewing today, so you can have some interaction with the folks who have done the work. Let's move to the next slide, D4. This is one of our most recent tools. It's an ecological restoration of lands tool. It's available at kluwen.org. The website is up there on the webpage. I think the site went live maybe about 2 weeks ago. We worked with EMS on this. And we basically did this so that we could create this to provide restoration managers, project managers, and anyone else with information and guidance on ecological restoration and revitalization, kind of a go-to resource directory. So if you look at this is the homepage here that's up on this slide. And on the left-hand side, there's some icons that start with home, glossary abbreviations, acronyms, et cetera. At any time you can hit the home button, it'll come back to this main page. Well, we've included the keywords that we pulled from some of the fact sheets and other resources that Ellen had talked about in her presentation and have them here. So if you need a definition for something, you can just click there. Talk about some principles of ecological restoration. Again, we pulled that from a lot of the fact sheets that Ellen has presented. Talk about why it's important for building soil health in order to get plants and ecosystems to come back into production. And then also some talk about plants and revegetation. Well, what I really want to talk to you a little bit more today are the last 2 icons, Act Locally and Organizations Involved in Restoration. I'm pretty excited about this because it provides you with people you can actually call and talk to in your area or your part of the country. So we're going to click, it's not interactive here, so we're going to pretend we clicked on the Act Locally icon, and let's go to the next slide. This is slide B5, and this is the internet page that comes up, which is the typical EPA regional map that you see on a lot of our web pages. So you can go to this page and click on your region of the map, and let's just say for demonstration purposes we want to look at region 3. So if you were to click on region 3, let's go to the next slide, which is B6. You'll get a more detailed map of region 3. And you'll find information on this page that's specific to these states in this part of the country. So if you were on this page and you scroll down, let's go to the next slide, which is B7. You'll find links to information specific to your EPA regional office, specific to your states. And the Federal Highway Administration has a great guide on use of native plants for every state in the country, and we've linked to that from these web pages for every state. So now we want to go back to the home page. So if you click on the next slide, we're back to that main page that I first started out talking to you about. And the other thing I want to show you is this, the last icon, the organizations involved in restoration. If you were to click on that icon, let's go to the next slide, you find a list of all federal, state, and academic institutions that we have identified that are working on ecological restoration and that are available for you to consult if you have questions in your particular part of the country. Really, that could be where academia comes in use. And a lot of the federal agencies can work on your project with you, like NOAA and BLM and NRCS presented to us last week. I just want to point out that this tool is a dynamic resource, and we put it out there in hoping that we will get folks like you who are on the seminar today to provide us with feedback and more information that should be included in this resource. We're hoping that you will give us feedback and let us know its usefulness. So please check it out. Let's go to the next slide, which is B10. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about some work, some research really that we're doing on carbon sequestration. Our office we have an EPA-wide group, and basically we're evaluating the current state of knowledge on the use of soil amendments and establishing plant growth on sites and the resulting potential for terrestrial carbon sequestration from these activities. So basically we're just calling through all the literature that's out there on this topic. One of our goals is to develop a protocol for being able to measure the amount and the ability to sequester carbon on these sites that have been restored, in hopes that we can maybe create a defensible soil and plant carbon accounting system. And eventually we will have a strategy and research plan where we will test this protocol that we come up with in the field to see if, you know, what we propose is really going to work and how we need to tweak it and just get an idea of the ability of carbon sequestration at sites, contaminated sites that are being remediated. If you go to the last slide, I just wanted to put out some thoughts of some future work that Ellen and I have brainstormed on along with some of our other colleagues. We're working on a guide that will talk about converting disturbed sites to green space. We would like to do a fact sheet on the sustainability of these sites, long-term stewardship type activities. We talked about doing some GIS mapping of where mine sites are in location to soil amendments, to see if it's really practical for you to use a certain amendment at your site based on distance and cost of fuel and transportation. And then we're always looking to engage experts, and we welcome your input. I put my contact information up here. Please get in touch with me. I really think that these resources can be beneficial to you when you're planning and implementing remediation at your site. And I do recommend that you visit all of the information that Ellen and I presented and try some of our tools and let us know what you think. And, you know, if you want to present some information about how you use these tools on your sites, we'd love to work at doing a seminar, a case study, or however we can get that information out to others. So I thank you for your attention. And at this time, I guess Ellen and I can take some questions. I noticed a bunch of questions coming in online here, so maybe we'll start with those, and then we'll open up the phone lines.
Okay.
The first question we have is, I think these first ones came in during Ellen's presentation, is where did we get the fact sheet? I think we put that information is out on our main webpage. It's cluein.org/eco-revitalization.
Yes. It's on slide 3 is the website that lists the 3 fact sheets, and it has a website there where you can get them all. And I believe you can also get them in the new webpage, Michelle just.
Right. Yeah. And there's an additional resources section on the main seminar page for today, and there's a link to that website too. So let's see. We have a question. What do you mean by amendments? Are we talking about biosolids?
We are talking about biosolids, but not just biosolids, and I think in the presentation it lists the different types of amendments we're looking at. I'm not sure what slide, but everything, any type of industrial or organic matter, residuals, if it's from biosolids, manures, compost, digestates, pulp sludges, yard and wood waste, ethanol byproducts, there's probably going to be a new big residual. We're also talking about not just organic matter, but how to neutralize pH. So for that, we would have lime products, wood ash, coal combustion products, sugar beet lime, and so then it's all in the paper.
Is the paper online yet, Ellen? We're about to get online?
It's about to get online. I think within the next couple of weeks, this paper will be online. We, upper management sat on it for a while. So what can you do? But it should be there within the next couple of weeks.
The next question, does the attractive nuisance species fact sheet include vegetative nuisance species in addition to wildlife? Project reviewed out of our office are strongly encouraged and recommend to use native plant species.
Oh, we definitely, in all our fact sheets, we encourage native plant species, and it's prominent, I think, in all of our fact sheets. Also, on our staff here, we have Scott Fredericks, who's actually here with us today, and he is a huge advocate and makes sure that we always mention that we prefer to use native plant species when possible.
Okay, the next question was about a link to the white paper. We already addressed that it will be online soon, and you'll be able to find that at clewin.org, where all of these other resources are available.
Yes. And is my email on this?
Yes.
And you know what, if I'd be happy to send you a draft, if you'd like, you can just send me an email and I'd be happy to send you a draft of it. It's finalized, it's just, you know, waiting, I don't know what it's waiting for, but I can send you a draft.
Okay, here's a long comment question that I'll read next. One typical problem faced with these types of solutions is getting cleanup money for remediating or entombing contaminants. Besides brownfields, which is competitive, has a long time turnaround and limited to $200,000, where will states, property owners, et cetera, get the funds to clean up these sites? For example, one type of contaminated site we have are old landfills in small rural communities. Most municipalities don't have funds to investigate these sites, much less take remedial actions. Until funds are made available to these types of communities to address these problems, they're going to sit there due to lack of funds. If there was funding specifically for ecological restoration remediation of these types of sites, we could help those communities and certainly be able to secure more land for open space and habitat. Will there be more funds available to work on these kinds of projects? We'd love to do it, but don't have much funds to do so.
Charles, I agree with you completely. I wish we had more funds to do this. We don't have any specific funds that I know of. I mean, I guess each state or county or city might be different. I don't know of any federal funds through EPA that would do this. You know, it could be part of your Superfund remediation process, but you know, there's the Brownfields grant that you mentioned. And I hope in the future the more information we get out about how important this is, the more funding will be available. So,
and part of I would step back to talk about the carbon sequestration research that we're doing, and part of the reason we're doing it is because a lot of this restoration is occurring anyway. If there was an added benefit of terrestrial carbon sequestration, maybe it would spark the interest of some folks to actually do this in parts of the country that are so isolated that no one's really interested in. Maybe I'm speaking if there was a carbon trading market at some point and you could use that value on that system.
I was just consulting and talking more about funding, which is area of frustration. It's true we don't have much funding, but we also hope by just providing this information and allowing people to know that they can do this and that this is options, that maybe they can be a little more creative with the funding and that funding will come in the future.
We have one more question, comment online here that I see. It says, the use of FOA amendments always gets questioned by consultants because of the situational challenges associated with each amendment. Ash can contain significant levels of metals. Off-site soils, in my experience, are often highly impacted, particularly in California. Selenium and arsenic, naturally occurring or concentrated, or urban areas. Yard waste from composting and mills can contain metals or petroleum and copper, arsenic, preservative waste. I would be very careful in generalizing the usefulness of soil amendments.
I would agree that you need to characterize everything, and that is emphasized in the paper, in that there's pros and cons to everything. I think biosolids are so heavily characterized right now that we know we're good with that. There are some issues with some other of the amendments which are mentioned in the paper, and we do recommend that you analyze everything before you use it. So good point. Thanks for bringing that up.
Okay, at this point I think we've answered all of the questions online, so I'd like to invite those of you that are on the telephone to, you can unmute your phone at this point and ask any questions of Ellen or myself. If you muted your phone, you can unmute it by hitting #6. So we'll take a couple questions or comments.
Hi, this is Adam Bukowski in Delaware. I would second that bit about analyzing your soil amendments. We have a site in the state where we use biosolids, or the PRPs use biosolids from the wastewater treatment plant to basically to remediate or to cover up metals contamination. Only the biosolids turned out to have a fair amount of PCBs in, so now we're in the process of remediating that.
I'm sorry, and I have heard of your site, and I'm sorry to hear that. So just to reiterate, you should characterize everything, but also know that there's dozens of sites that have been very successful, but you need to be careful.
Any other questions or comments?
Greg Dukowski again. How does, I've always heard of the uncrossable line between remediation and restoration at EPA. Under Superfund, and it seems like that line is starting to blur, and I think that's a good thing, but I wondered if you could comment on what extent that line still exists and what distinctions we have to be careful to make.
So you were asking about the profitability of eco-restoration?
No, I'm a natural resource trustee here in Delaware, and we were always told that there was a hard and fast line between remediation and NERDA, and that, you know, neither side could cross to the other side under Superfund. It sounds like that line maybe isn't as hard and fast as it used to be, and I'm just wondering about that.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. Yes, I think in the past people believe that you had to clean up the site, but then you couldn't restore it. But a lot of the cleaning up the site is restoring it. And I think people are starting to view it from a different picture now, so that line's not there as much anymore. Good point.
Any more questions or comments on the phone? I guess we'll take this one last question online here. What is your definition of sustainability? It is a term commonly used now and means something different to each group. How do you propose to reach a consensus definition?
Do you mean for the fact sheet that we mentioned sustainability for the upcoming work we're going to do?
Yeah, I think like sustainability and the long-term stewardship and identifying the utility and...
Oh, well, we did, you know, initially when we did the workshop in Chicago, we wanted to do three papers. One on just a white paper on the basics and background on using soil amendments and the problems associated with that and the solutions. And the second one was, you know, this performance measure document that we completed to say, okay, once you used it, how do we prove that it's really working and that the site's ready for reuse? And the third one is, how do we know it's good in 10 years? And that's what we were talking about in long-term stewardship is, you know, if we apply these amendments, you know, what happens in the future to the site. And so that's actually something we hope to start working on soon, but we haven't really started that other than talking and thinking, so we're not quite there.
And I don't know, I'm going to mention it, that Ellen is going to be going to work with ORD's Office of Sustainability, so perhaps that will help us with the you know, getting a consensus and how to reach one.
Yeah, so hopefully you'll see more work in the future on this issue.
Another question came in, so we'll take this one real quick. Are there issues with plant species that should be avoided in some cases to keep from disturbing buried waste, for example, oaks, which have tap roots, despite the fact that they're native? Do you guys have suggestions for dealing with these species in an environmentally sensitive fashion? Oh, that's from Jim Carlton. Hi, Jim.
Well, read the fact sheet, and we give you some links to the NRCS, which has suggestions for what native plants you can use in your site to deal with the location, the weather, native species, and it's all site-specific. So I encourage you to look at the fact sheet, look at the resources, and if you have any specific questions to your site, then let one of us know. But the trees are fine. Wait, let me read it one more thing. Trees are fine. I think there was a lot of confusion at first that you can't plant trees on a landfill because they will go through the liner, and the research has proven that's just not true, that the roots will grow down until they hit the liner and then go sideways. And so there's a lot of peer-reviewed journal articles on that issue, if that's sort of what the question was leaning towards also. I want to let people know about that. And I think that there's one of the archive seminars, there's a lot of information on that.
Yeah.
And I forget which one.
Yeah, there is one of the archive seminars. It's all about revegetating landfills.
Right.
And you'll find that on one of the slides of my presentations where it lists the slides that listed all the archive seminars. There's a link to where you could view that. Okay. Well, I thank everyone for their attention. And we do have another presentation. So if you unmuted your phone, I ask that you remute it by hitting *6. And we're going to have Danielle Green do a presentation on some restoration work that she's done in the Great Lakes area. Danielle is in EPA's Great Lakes National Program Office, and she has some really interesting case studies to present to us. So,
Hi there. So I'm going to transport you over to the Great Lakes, and a lot of what I'm talking about is after we've done some of the remediation, what do you do for the restoration? So now I'm on the second slide. So in this presentation, I want to talk about some of the ecological restoration we've done, and I'm going to have to get you up to speed on a little bit of the Great Lakes speak. Every kind of ecosystem has their own purview, and then switch over to some of the natural landscaping, just so that you know some of the resources that we have. I'm now on slide C3, and remediation to restoration, it's more than birds and bunnies. A lot of the genesis for this slide came in that a lot of the remediation stuff, the toxic reduction, is acknowledged that it's a really big science, but then at least in some Great Lakes examples, the ecological restoration would happen that some seeds would get scattered, or there'd be some research on what are the native plants appropriate, and then seeds would get scattered, as opposed to kind of the recognition that that also is as much of a science as the remediation aspect. On the next slide, a lot of the work that we're doing, I'm on C4 right now, is using Society of Ecological Restoration International. They have a primer on ecological restoration, and definitions always come up. And so what we are really using for definition here is their definition of ecological restoration. It's a process of assisting the recovery of an ecosystem that's been degraded, damaged, or destroyed. And then on the next slide, it talks about just some of the characteristics that need to be there. Native species, that the restoration is integrated into a larger landscape. The resiliency is really important, and also that it's self-sustaining to some degree. It's the same degree as a reference ecosystem, another area. Another really important fact is that the sites that we are working on, that we get to, are changed. A lot of time ecological restoration, you look back 10,000 years ago, but we're not going to be able to restore the amount of pervious and impervious surfaces within a watershed has been changed, so it's really looking at all those things and seeing what you can restore to for the future. A lot of the restoration, I'm on C6 right now, is, you know, some of the typical engineering solutions. C7 is, okay, so we need to convey water, and we get it off as quick as legally possible, but this is not the ecological restoration, and we certainly can do better and do better now. As promised, there is the Great Lakes context, just to give the example of the work that that we're doing. See all these dots are these places called areas of concern around the Great Lakes Basin, and they are listed because they are impaired, as defined in an international agreement with Canada. There are analogies, I think, for these areas of concern for other contaminated sites that people around the country are dealing with. On the next slide, really the important part of this is that there are three of these beneficial use impairments, which is why these things are designated as problems, as areas of concern that are related to habitat: degradation of fish and wildlife populations, the degradation of benthos, and the loss of fish and wildlife habitats. This gives the context of the work that we've been doing of how do you say that enough is enough, that it's cleaned up enough, it is restored enough that you can delist, you can get off this nasty list of this area of concern. And so what we really did, I'm just going to go quickly through these next set of slides, is that we look where the habitat is impaired in a site, the next slide on C11. Then we look at the ecological information. This really goes back to the SER definition, Society of Ecological Restoration definition. You look at the ecological description of the site. You look for a reference or target ecosystem somewhere else that's not as impaired that you could be restoring it to, or at least taking into impact. Look at some of the sites and schedules and costs and some of the performance standards. And then for C12, the next slide, also know, so one of the ideas we came up with that we were going to do ecological restoration master plan. What could happen at this site ecologically? How can we kind of, after the land is healed from the toxics have been removed, what can we do next? I realize that some of the really important aspects are the landowners need to approve, and it has to be their plan and their idea. The community needs to be adopting it and figuring out for the implementation of those actions. A case study that really is using this, it's in one of those area, Great Lakes areas of concern. It's if you go to C13, the case study is Hog Island in Newton Creek, and actually C14 shows where it is. This is in Wisconsin, just over the bridge from Minnesota. So this is Superior, Wisconsin. And if you look, if everybody's on C14, you can see the Hog Island Inlet. This was, there was a bunch of money that came in the Great Lakes to remove Great Lakes Legacy Act, to remove contaminated sediments. And this is one of the first spots. This is right on Lake Superior. It's one of the first kind of sheltered areas. If you go to the next slide, which is C15, you'll see more specifically, if you see that little red outline, that is the inlet. If you go up inland, there's Newton Creek. That was also had contaminated remediation, contaminants removed. And the island itself is actually still from the 50s from all the dredging. It's a big port area around there. So C16 shows that this picture on C16 is the inlet. It was dewatered. Contaminated sediments were removed. C17, more cool backhoe shots. C18, another backhoe shot. And then we said, okay, so now what? We have this stuff. It is clean, but we still want to get ecological functioning to go on. So we were able to get a contractor through using GSA, and the two expertises that we really needed was to be able to have ecological restoration expertise and also community facilitation skills to listen to the community. So we had a series of meetings. So there was a kickoff meeting and then three public workshops. And the idea was to take the community vision and to also kind of learn about what is known ecologically about the site and turn it into actions. C20 is, my computer is going through, is this is one of the contractors doing some of the data reconnaissance and really looking on the site. C21, you have part of the public meetings. There, if you see the posters on the boards, they really took a lot of what was known about the site and put it up and gave people Sharpies. I actually recommend water-based pens because Sharpies bleed to the wall. I also did an exercise where it asked people what their vision is, which is what that bumper sticker was, because you want to be able to get it articulated succinctly. And if people wanted more recreation, if they wanted it more passive so that it was really just a nature area, and then how you translate that. We came out, C22 is the plan. I am going to just go through a few aspects of that. It will be on the website for my office, which is www.epa.gov/GLNPO, which stands for Great Lakes National Program Office. I expect it will be in the next few months that will go on. If somebody wants a disc for this, because I think the layout is really interesting in the way that it was really it was looked at, I'm happy to send that if you want this more quickly. So C23, just to give an idea what was in there, talks about kind of the existing conditions in the site, why we're doing it, who was in there, what the visions were and the guiding principles. C24 goes specifically, just kind of circling some of the information from the ecological restoration plan, talks about some of the goals, some of the phasing, and other aspects. C25, really hard to read, I'm sorry. I just wanted to give an example how pretty it is, if you can see it. And this is really the objective C1, which is talking about getting rid of some of the invasive species, an issue that's nationwide. C25, they even specifically gave an idea. This is Hog Island. I'm C26 right now. And if you see that yellow perimeter, piping plover is a target species, really important for the area, and that could possibly be restored to the next, in the restoration, could be restored so that target species would be able to have more habitat. C27, in the next few slides, I will go through just very quickly, but it just seems very important to show one of the, to me, the most important part is the phasing of the restoration actions. So C28, it gives specific activities for years 0 to 1. I'm not going to go through all of these. You can go through them later, but just to show in years 2 to 4 after the master plan adoption, and that's a really important aspect. If this is being done for a community, it's got to have local ownership. And the landowners, whether it is, in this case, it turned out to be some private industry and a lot of county and municipality owning it, were the ones that were going to have to make changes. So these had to be things that were helpful to them. Going through C30 has 5 to 10 years from the master plan adoption. A lot of it deals with invasives and planting and then monitoring, especially as you get further out. Phase 4, which is on C31, 11 years to completion, is you continue the monitoring and you continue public outreach and environmental stewardship and the education aspect. On slide C32, it's really important for one of the reasons my office is involved in this is that there are these areas of concern. We want to delist them. We want to be able to declare victory. A lot of the toxics that are cleaned up. Because, you know, the ecological restoration takes 20 years, 30 years to take hold. Where is it that you can delist, where you can say everything is in place and it is on the trajectory towards full recovery, and when can we delist this? And so we actually have kind of set this up that we're not going to be able, we're not saying you have to wait the 30 years for full recovery, but if you have the restoration in sight, you have a ecological management plan for your invasives and continued monitoring, that is when we would be able to consider that this is restored. And our role, the Great Lakes National Program Office role in this, is something that really has to be the community adoption. But in addition to kind of spearheading the idea and getting, you know, fabulous contractors in there that have ecological restoration experience and community facilitation experience, that we also had committed that we would be finding funding or helping them look for funding or grant opportunities and such to fund some of these. In the master plan itself, in addition to the timeline and how long it takes, there is a cost guesstimate for the design phase of each of those actions so that when the local government, in the case for Hog Island, it's the county, are looking for funding, they know kind of what is more expensive and what is less expensive and what fits. Just quickly, some of the recipes that we found that were successful for the ecological restoration master plan to come in place is that it was eliminated or controlled sources of pollution. And in fact, one of the ideas for that Newton Creek that was upland is if the hydrology changes, if the flow changes, and it's really very, very much controlled by an oil refinery that is upstream, what would that do? Would that scour out more and bring more sediments out that maybe were not part of the initial remediation? All that really has to be looked at. We were able to have a really good ecological restoration expert and a facilitator. The state and local agencies wanted us in there. They knew that they could do more, and they just weren't sure what it would be. The site was accessible. There is a small portion that's owned by railroads. I would love anybody's example of successful partnerships with railroad landowners to facilitate ecological restoration. But most of the other site, and even the industrial things other than the railroad ownership, we had accessibility to it. It was a very inclusive process. Everybody's ideas were brought in up front and translated into ecological restoration ideas. There was the reference ecosystem and the institutional capacity. Somebody was going to be able to take this over and move it so it wasn't just a beautiful document on a shelf. On C-35, just to show you, because Hog Island was a place that was much, it's not that built up there. There's a lot of open space. There was a lot of infiltration and such, and even in the watershed itself, there still is a lot of infiltration. We're also working in places that are in Muskegon, Michigan, White Lake is in Michigan, Ashtabula, there's a lot of sediment and stuff going on. This is in Ohio, and the Black River is another area that we're going to be getting to in Ohio that are much more urbanized, and we're also looking at this as a solution to be able to think about the ecological restoration after some of the toxic harm and risk has been contained. C-36 just shows you a aerial view of just how built up Muskegon Lake is. And C-37, just want to talk about some of the tools that we have, because funding is always an issue. We have a really big interest in the Great Lakes because these are these areas of concern. We've been working on them for 20, 25 years. We're really close to getting rid of eliminating a lot of the toxics issues for that, and how do we deal with the ecological restoration side. We were able to work, and I'm happy to talk with anybody after this on the Fed level. Through GSA, there are contractors. I mean, contractors, I love having great ecological restoration experts on there, and it was relatively easy for us to get, once we figured out our statement of work and what we wanted to accomplish, to find some good ecological restoration experts through that. We also have grants to states that we are able to do without competition from this office. And then there's also competitive grants within the Great Lakes Watershed Program. On C-38, this is just my contact information. I know it is also up as far as the seminar, and Karen Rodriguez, a colleague I work with. I'm happy to answer any questions about this. And then I want to switch gears a little bit to talk about, this is a presentation, and I'm going to go through fairly quickly on natural landscaping, which is kind of the green infrastructure. So the ecological restoration is you're looking for the resiliency and the self-sustaining, and really looking at from the hydrology to the soils to the native plants, whereas this is more the green infrastructure side of things, kind of talking about the hidden impacts of landscaping. Any of these slides, these are developed in the Great Lakes. Anybody wants to use, please go ahead, and hopefully they're of use. So C-40 is talking about kind of the sustainable landscaping with the advantages of the pollution prevention and getting more ecological function and the look, the attractiveness. C-41, the air pollution issues, and this is really looking in Chicagoland area, which is an entertainment area. The one-hour mowing gas is like 20 miles driving in a car, and it talks about the VOCs and the health impacts. Again, in the Chicago area, showing about how important it is that some of these off-road, meaning the landscaping things, are a significant contributor to the pollution problems we have here. In C-43, as we are loading it, talks about some of the water pollution, point sources and how runoff, the stuff that just goes off of typical lawns, and in agriculture, really does, it doesn't just stay on place. There is no place, no such thing as a way. It doesn't just go off your property. In C-44, there's some information on kind of the pesticides aspect and how much is used in pesticides. These numbers are probably 6-7 years old. I have not updated it since then. If anybody knows of more current information, I would love to be able to know that. C-45 talks about fertilizers, and if you see, goose poop is everywhere. and talking about just kind of the phosphorus and nitrogen and that aspect of it gets into the waterways. And C46, this is actually taken from Arboretum in Philadelphia, I believe, the sign that garden pollution affects our streams and how just things don't just stay on one place or there is no such thing as a way. It really does impact the environment. C47 talks about the erosion, flood damage and erosion, and just how typical turf, if you see some of these retention ponds, that there are better ways to do it rather than having turf up to the thing. C48, you saw that slide in the beginning, and it's just kind of the conveyance of water and what you do and how we can change for natural landscaping to celebrate rather than just get water off land as much as possible and quickly as possible. C49 is another conveyance that you see in kind of a typical subdevelopment, at least here in the Midwest. And C50, this is the evil. Okay, so you've got the parking lot, all the muck is draining into the drain, and as you see, it's gone right into that pond with the riprap and the grass going down to it. And then the soldier trees just kind of merging along right there. C51 kind of goes into some of the alternatives, and this is a bioswale, so just other ways that you can treat parking lots and parking areas to be able to infiltrate water, to celebrate water on site. On C52 talks about kind of the harm to biodiversity and bringing that up and pesticides, and in addition to birds, non-target species being poisoned, that they're there's less than 1% of the 500,000 species that are really the pest, and a lot of the other ones get harmed with the pesticide use. In C53, this is one of my favorite images. It's a rainy day. I don't know how well it comes out on your PowerPoint. And the sprinklers are on. Water is a big, big issue. There are a lot of watering restrictions around here and a lot of drought summers, and it's obviously a nationwide thing. And just thinking about how we can do things better. And C54 gets into the tricky thing, the aesthetics. Because to some people, this might look beautiful. And the same thing with C55 and just, big running area. One of the best things that I use in talks that I give is for lawn and for turf is that if the only thing visiting that part of the lawn is a lawnmower, you might want to consider planting something different. And obviously my advocacy is for something native and regional to your area. In C56, I have kind of the implications of traditional landscaping. So this is kind of the good, the bad of just the pollution side, the erosion, the harm to biodiversity, and the monotony. And obviously that is a very, everyone has their own perspective on that. And C57 is my other way to wrap it up, and this is kind of what we're trying to get away from, is this Woody Allen quote of nature and I are two. We're trying to figure out how to integrate nature into things. And C58 is another aspect which comes in, and this is Edge City, which is a cartoon that's syndicated in Chicago. Basically talks about a couple, and she's planting, and she's so excited they're native plants. And look how big and beautiful and full. And then, okay, so here's someone from the village saying, okay, it's against our weed ordinance, basically, $50 a day till you clean it up. And that really is kind of local permission, and how different municipalities or townships deal with this is an important aspect when you're advocating use of native plants. In C59, I love this quote, and this to me is like the anti-Bennigan Anyway, whenever I go in America, I like it when the land speaks its own language in its own regional accent. So it's against the franchise that you can go anywhere in the country, and it's the same plants everywhere, but celebrating what's local and regional in your area and how beautiful that can be. In C60, talks about kind of naturalistic design and just how that can require less maintenance. And then the environmental good that comes from it. 61. These examples are Midwest examples. They are things that you can use anywhere. And the native plants and the reasons to do it, they're best adapted to the local conditions. There are a lot of variety and beauty. They won't harm natural areas, the habitat value, and also that sense of place. That was from the quote from Lady Bird Johnson. And C62 talks about the right plant in the right place, where you really look at your sites and you see what is there and what would thrive on sites, so you're not fighting in nature. And C63 gives three Midwest examples. The one on the left is butterfly weed. It's the milkweed family, really beautiful for sunny flowers. In the middle is foam flower, which is great in shady areas. And then cardinal flower is the beautiful plant on the red, which is great in wet areas. C64, some examples of naturalistic design. The one on the left is a corporate campus. On the right is a home. There are also much more formalistic ways that you can do it. People, that's where the aesthetics come in. C65, this is actually a City of Chicago Park District property, and high rises, there's a John Hancock building way, so you're looking kind of towards Michigan Avenue from the north side of the city, towards downtown. C66, this is more of a formalistic way of using different native plants. This is actually a photo from the East Coast. C67 also just has some more of these examples. And Dan Walker, who used to be with EPA Region 3, these are actually from a summer home of his, a few of those. C68, I think this is a really, really important thing, the stop sign. Natural landscaping is not an excuse to just let weeds go and say it's natural. Natural landscaping is very highly designed and conceived, and so the plants and what fits in the site and what will help kind of the ecological water function and other functions of the area is taken into impact. It is not just, hey, let it go and say I'm natural. In C69, I always say, and this is unfortunately everybody can put in their own examples, that a lot of the beginning of the talk is do good, and at the very least, do no evil. And so there are a series of slides that give information on invasive plants, buckthorn being really one of the bad guys around here, and I'm sure a lot of other places, purple loosestrife, invasive, like the bush honeysuckles. C72 talks about for prairies, and I know meadows are not appropriate everywhere. There are places that have woodland, and that is much more appropriate to where you're working or others. But shows kind of the examples here for meadows and the prairie things of how long the root systems are. In the very left, if you see the turf grass, 3 to 5 inches, which I need so much care and maintenance, and then going down to 10 feet. C73 shows that roots hold soil, and then if you go to C74, and these are this is a property just north of Milwaukee, in the suburb north of Milwaukee. This property here with all this erosion is right next door. I mean, you stand and you take this incredible property, and you see all this native landscaping that was going down all the way down, and the bottom is Lake Michigan. And then if you see what the turf does and the erosion there, I thought it was just very striking. C75 talks about some of the energy conservation and cooling, which in the world of climate change, and what can you do to reduce energy consumption is really important. And this is not just for native plants. Trees are really an important aspect of this. And the roots holding water is C76. This was taken also in a western suburb of Chicago during a drought year when there were water restrictions. And if you see the far property and the parched turf, there was no additional watering that was put in the four section, which has probably only a third of an acre. Just incredible biodiversity and value. And the things flowered in a little funky timing. Everything was just gorgeous and green. Stormwater retention is really an important aspect, C77. And then some examples of rooftop gardens. There may be examples in your local area, but you feel free to take these if they are of use. C78, C79, which I don't know how many people are aware of, is City Hall in Chicago, and it is think that the building is landmarked, so there is no fencing or any alterations allowed to the building. The interesting part is right here. What you see is the city. The back part, which is hard to see kind of by the other white, is the county, and that is black asphalt. So they've been able to do a lot of metrics and look at the difference for the urban heat island effect and such to get the measurement differences for temperature. Moving on to 80, just some examples of rain gardens. This is before and after, and this is up in Maplewood, I believe, in Minnesota. Here's another Maplewood example. Not all these plants are native within this, but they did a whole lot for retention and kind of metrics for stormwater. And then in C82, talking about native plants being used for ecological value, which is really kind of that green infrastructure, and what can you do in more urbanized area to bring some ecological function back. Next series of slides were taken, the next three are native trees, taken October-ish, you know, because cold here, things are about to drop and they're changing, and you see everything's kind of munched. Here's the oak, if you see the next, all munched up, C85, all munched up, it's about to drop, it's re-releasing back the stored energy for the bugs and the critters to get through the winter. C86 is a Norway maple, a non-native tree. It's in perfect shape. It's I can understand, and actually first time I gave this was at the Smithsonian a bunch of years ago to horticulturalists, and at first maybe that's a perfect specimen because, you know, you want the green and you want your design look, but what is it really adding for the ecological value? Is it really giving back? Some of the context, C87, and I'm happy to have conversations after this because I know there's a lot of information here, is about the Chicago Wilderness is a consortium in Chicago area of 225 organizations committed to enhancing the biodiversity of this area, which is basically the crescent around Lake Michigan from southeast Wisconsin, maybe eight counties in Illinois going into northwest Indiana and now even up into southeast Michigan. And there's a biodiversity recovery plan. Native landscaping, in addition to the ecological restoration, is a really important aspect of that plan. In C88, this is to talk about a conference that we held in December 2004 to quantify the benefits of landscaping with native plants. And in C89, you can see the areas that we looked at. There is air, water, carbon sequestration, phytoremediation, economics, public perception, pesticides, and fertilizer. I am sad to say that there is not a lot of peer-reviewed scientific hard numbers out there. The hope was that you get those numbers, and then municipalities who maybe want to put in stormwater retention ponds that are more naturalized rather than riprap or other aspects would be able to say, hey, I'm using my money for my county or for my township, and I'm getting this amount of environmental benefit from there. There's still a lot of questions. The research agenda that actually came out of there is posted on our website, the Green Acres website, which I'll have posted. You'll have the URL in a moment. If you go to C90, though, a few of the interesting things that came out of it from the air side of things was that if you converted 1,000 acres of turf, basically, and we were really looking at corporate campuses, could be any contiguous amount of corporate turf to prairie, meaning that you would do burn maintenance once a year, once every few years versus the mowing, is that it's 18 tons per year of VOC emissions that are prevented in the air. It talks about the energy, water, and then the cost operations that are saved, especially from a corporate campus and what they have to spend for their maintenance folks. And some really important information that came out of this, Joe Nassauer is a professor at University of Michigan in their School of Natural Resources and Environment. She's a landscape architect and does a lot of social perception information. And one of her main messages, and she was a participant at the conference that we had in 2004, oh my gosh, 3 years ago, she was saying basically that when you're doing landscape design, if it is not acceptable to the public, it doesn't matter how ecologically viable it is, or what it's doing to help with that, it really, the next manager or administration, if they think it's ugly, it's going to go out. And so some of the things that show that something is cared for and gets more social and public acceptability is kind of cues for care, that somebody is taking care of it, the C91. C92 has more of those cues for care, has some of a design element in it, some setback to it. And then C93 shows that it kind of is formal, and it's the sustainable natural landscaping that they're designed for perception in addition to the ecological function, and that way they will really last and have the community sustainability, the community voice, and backing for it. The last thing, it's getting cold here, and so this is, we have the Conservation and Native Landscaping Award that EPA does in partnership with the Chicago Wilderness. This is some information from 2005, some of our award winners, so I guess I'm ending with eye candy. If anybody is interested in doing some of these from the recognition side, I am happy to give some information on things that we have learned along the way. We have our 2007 award ceremony on Thursday in 3 days. I've got the award plaques right next to me right now. And it is a way for us to recognize good behaviors on public land towards that kind of green infrastructure and sustainability and getting away from the 300 acres of mow turf that are some of the examples of some of the corporate campuses around here. So the C94 has the Morton Arboretum, which is in the western suburbs of Chicago. This is all within the Chicago wilderness, kind of that crescent around Lake Michigan. C95, this is Humboldt Park, which is Chicago Park District. So this is very inner city area. C96 has another picture of that. This was a Jens Jensen design from 100 years ago. C97 is a former Superfund site in Libertyville, Illinois, now a very beautifully used park, and in the far end is a high-quality forest preserve, so forest preserve district. C98 is a former Glenview Naval Air Station that was, when the air base moved out, there was a lot of ecological restoration and native landscaping that went in, and it's a highly used site. A village hall is on C99, and they use that to show developers what ponds can look like. C100 just shows some of the nominees. We have it open for park districts, municipalities, developers, and it turns out there's a lot of homeowners associations and corporations that apply for this. And then I love the before and after pictures. So if you look at 101, Botanic Garden, this is their shoreline before. And then 102 is after. They did, I think, 150 acres worth of plantings, maybe even a little bit more than that. They even have some areas where they kept it as turf as kind of educational. Almost at the end, 103 is another beautiful after picture for the Chicago Botanic Garden. C104 is a fairly high-end homeowners association in one of the southwest suburbs of Chicago. And another, C105 is another beautiful picture of kind of the landscaping that went in. C106, I think, is really interesting because it is one of those, originally it was one of those riprap places when you were going through, and it was basically a retention pond with a string of development that was built on an old cornfield, and there's just lots of them, and they all look very much the same. There was a birder that lived there. If you look to 107, this is one of the after pictures, and it was just somebody wanted birds closer to their house. And they did it, and it was within the same amount of money that the homeowners association puts in. It's obviously a very different look. 108 is another one of the after pictures of these fairly modest subdevelopments and what can be done on that property rather than the riprap. 109 shows kind of just on the park district and Department of Transportation working together for there was a new underpass under Lakeshore Drive. This is right on Lake Michigan. And 110, is it loading on my computer, just shows just kind of how it really emulates the dunes. This is on one of the bike paths. It is just very, very highly used. the partnerships there. C-111 is kind of the drawing, the schematic, kind of the art that goes into this in addition to the science. And one other example that we have awarded with our natural landscaping award is ComEd, the local utility here. There was a remnant prairie, and they've been working with a local restoration group for years. They allow them to do burns under this, if you see on C-113. And it is a very, it's basically, it's a really beautiful example of partnership between local stewardship group, community organization, and the ComEd allowing access for their property. And then C-114, Motorola, kind of a before and after. They are one of the corporations that have a really, really large area. And this is truly kind of towards the back. It's not their opening shot, but it is something that's really highly used by a lot of their employees, and even community people come in and take photos there. Lastly, as I will open up this for pictures, is our Green Acres website. The URL for that, that's on slide 116. We are doing a revamp in addition of the Green Acres site of the larger ecosystem page that is on the www.epa.gov/glenpo, Green Acres will be available from there. You can go right to the Green Acres site. But also on that ecosystem page will be a lot of the remediation to restoration information that I was talking about before. And I will end there and be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thanks, Danielle. I'm impressed in the amount of information you just presented to us, and I look forward to reading some of the questions from folks online. So we'll do that first. We'll read some of the questions we got in online here, and then we'll open the phones. One question that came in, this might be related more to Ellen and my presentation. It says, following up to my earlier funding question, more of a comment, I think it would be good for folks who are putting together the technical resources for these types of projects also to track down the many potential sources of funds from somewhat disparate programs such as USDA, BLM, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, private foundations, et cetera. Do you think you could also begin to bring this type of information together along with the technical resources? And I guess my answer would be yes, and I think it's a great suggestion, and part of that online resource tool that we presented, I think that we should develop a funding section or something along these lines where you can go to find out how to get more financial resources for your project.
Yeah, sounds good.
Let's see. We have a question here. Who has oversight on management and monitoring of invasives? I think all of us understand the issues that are born from stressed resources, have witnessed wetland restoration with great intention. Monitoring doesn't seem to occur over time, and chances of success are reduced and many times eliminated. Seems to be more of a comment. I don't know if you want to respond to that.
I will say in the work that we're doing that we did up in Hog Island, it was really important, and in some of the other areas for the Great Lakes, it was really important to have local ownership and that they understood that monitoring and that longer-term management and carrying out that management plan was really important for the success. So that was part of the conversations in our targeting the areas, but certainly it is a really important aspect.
The next question we have is, what programs are there that will get regional native plant associations, such as the New England Wildflower Association, to make contact with remediation and landfill closure agencies? Is there an agency contact?
I think that it would be, I don't think there's one agency contact. I think there would be contacts within each regional office of EPA. There's 10 regional offices throughout the country, and that by our hope here with Michelle and I is to let our regional folks know that they can restore landfills and they can replant on them, and to give them some of these organizations like the Plant Conservation Alliance and then for them to look in their local areas that they would go ahead and do that. If you have a certain site that you're looking at, you know, feel free to contact us, and we can try to get you in touch with the regional person.
And I'll mention one more thing on the resource tool that I presented. The information on these types of native plant associations, it's our goal to have them up there. So folks know, if you click on Pennsylvania, you know that there is a native plant association in Pennsylvania, and there's a contact name there. So as that information is, you know, coming into us and we're becoming aware of it, we will put it on our website. So hopefully that'll make people more aware. I don't see any more questions on the online system, so at this point I think we can open the phones up to those of you who would like to ask a question. You can unmute your phone by hitting #6. So anyone has a question or comment, please speak up.
I have a question, Maria from New York City Department of Environmental Protection for, I guess, Danielle.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything out there that I can go to quickly, like the first two presenters mentioned, with the amount of time that I have? I don't always have the time to go and look at articles published, approved for density in terms of restoration. And the restoration of site.
Density as far as?
As far as plant species. You know, we'll get a site that somebody is building a 300-acre subdivision, lots, and they need to mitigate for green space or for stormwater or wetland impact. And they'll generally show stormwater basins. And some maybe an acre basin, and they'll give me 1,000 plants for each species. And I really am not clear on if that's acceptable or if it's not. We have a lot of sites and data. We just haven't been able to get to it yet. So since you had such great examples of successes, I wondered if you might have some.
I don't, but let me look into that and get back. Is there, Michelle, is there a way to get this back to the large group if I find out anything? That?
Yes, we have the contact information for all of the individuals who had joined the conference today.
Okay.
But the woman who asked the question, can you tell me your name specifically?
Sure, Maria Tupper Goebel.
Vogel is the last name?
No, Tupper Goebel, T-U-P-P-E-R, G-O-E-B as in boy, E-L.
Okay. We'll have Danielle follow up with you on that.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Well, I want to thank everyone for your attention today, and our presentations, I think, were very valuable. I would ask you, if you look on the last slide, C-117, we provide links to additional resources, which there should be links to all of the things we presented to you today. And then I also want to encourage you to go to the feedback forum and fill out our questionnaire and let us know what you thought about our presentation today and any suggestions you have for future Internet seminars or resources that you would like to see. And then I'll mention one more thing. We do have another seminar on Wednesday from 2 to 4. And you will find a link to that and our additional resources page, too. And also the link was on in my presentation. This is Michelle speaking. But anyway, I want to thank everyone for your time today and appreciate you your interest in this topic. And I think that we'll definitely have some more interesting things to present in the future.